Welcome to Focus on the Community, produced by the DLC Media News Center. I'm Dave Crooks. Today, my special guest is the creator of IndyPolitics.org, and he's also a WIBC Radio Statehouse reporter, Abdul Akeem Shabazz of Indianapolis. On today's program, we will cover a wide range of topics, including the latest from the short session of the Indiana General Assembly and an update on politics in the Hoosier State. Abdul, welcome to Focus on the Community.
David, my friend, always good to talk to you good folks down there in southern Indiana. Happy to have a discussion today.
Well, it's good to have you on the program, and since you seem to walk the halls of the Statehouse daily, especially during the session, and I haven't been doing that for several years, I figured I would get an insider's look at what's going on as we are pretty much past the midpoint of the General Assembly. What are the hot issues that are still being debated, I guess, in both the House and the Senate that Hoosier should know more about?
We've got lots of issues that are out there. First of all, you've got the governor's emergency situation with the COVID pandemic. And you basically got two versions of what's going on. You got the three things the governor asked lawmakers to do, which is in the House version of that bill and the Senate version of that bill. But in the House version of that bill, in addition to giving the governor the three things he needed to lift the state of emergency, the House decided to go ahead and lift and exempt employees from certain employee vaccination mandates. So what the House did was they passed a bill that basically said you can have a medical exemption, you can have a religious exemption, or what they call an immunity exemption as well. Now, that was not put in the Senate version of things, so that's going to be a point of contention because I categorically say this is the curse of Indiana being in great fiscal shape, because when you got money, you don't have to worry about those types of issues, so all these other little issues start to bubble up. These sort of cultural issues sort of bubble up all over the place. And so what you've got, in a sense, is you've got some folks on some of the far ideological right, some of the anti-vaxxer crowd and some of the quote-unquote pro-freedom crowd, that say, hey, you know, we don't want businesses telling us what to do, what to put in our bodies, which is fine. But at the same time, though, this is a person's business. And I always thought Indiana was sort of a business-friendly kind of at-will state. I mean, you don't have to work here, but if you do work here, then you got to do what I ask you to do. So you got that kind of back and forth. The House passed their version. The Senate, they passed their version of the bill, which, like I said, just has the things the governor needed lifted in his emergency notice mandate. So that's going to be a point of contention, because unlike, say, you got the House wants to spend $1 billion, the Senate wants to spend $2 billion. Okay, we'll split the difference at 1.5. Either you want the mandate or you don't.
And where's the State Chamber of Commerce at these days? Are they still pushing for the mandate to get people vaccinated, or have they kind of softened their posture lately?
Their belief basically has always been is that because they have different businesses that are sort of all over the place with this issue. So their thing is that they prefer the government not tell businesses what to do. They'll let the businesses sort of decide, let the businesses determine whether they should have their employees vaccinated or not vaccinated.
But they've at least been very vocal. It seems like I've seen Kevin Brendiger, their state executive director, pushing to get people vaccinated so they can get the numbers in better shape. So it just seems like that they say one thing, that's not really a mandate request, but they're sure urging people to get vaccinated, aren't they?
They're urging people to get vaccinated, but they don't want the government mandating vaccinations. I think that's more Kevin's position, because they were against the federal mandates. When the Biden administration decided to put those in for businesses that had more than 100 employees. But at the same time, though, they don't want the state basically telling them either, hey, you can't do mandates. Like their sort of philosophy has always been sort of let the businesses decide what's best for them, but we prefer people be vaccinated.
And will the Republican majority be successful in kind of overtaking the governor's executive authority on calling for these emergencies? Because I know some have not liked the way he's handled COVID, even though I think – for the most part, he's done a pretty good job navigating this, it looks like to me.
Yeah, and I think part of the issue is that, number one, you've got, because of the way districts are drawn, you got a lot more sort of ideological people to the right, and also you got a primary coming up, which ironically, as we record this interview Friday, is the filing deadline. And so I always kind of jokingly said maybe session should start on February 5th, sort of after
right
after the filing deadline, so you have to worry about all this far right or far left legislation or people introducing things just to make a certain group of constituents happy. You can actually get the business of governing actually done. There's a big shocker there. But it's going to be interesting to see what lawmakers work out. We spoke to Senator Rod Bray on Wednesday, Tuesday, when lawmakers were getting ready to wind down for the first half of session. And he was like, there's going to be some amendments and lots of discussion. And I think Todd Houston said it best, the new speaker, that don't pay so much attention to us as to where we start, but look at where we end up. Now, granted, between where you start and where you finish, there's lots of little twists and turns along the way, which will kind of determine, you know, whether folks will end up. But I think it's interesting to see what will happen as lawmakers come back on Monday.
So you mentioned Todd Houston. He's the new speaker. You've got, of course, Rod Bray, the new speaker pro tem in the Senate. So you've got two new leaders running both chambers. The majority party obviously has full control. How is that working out so far to have two newbies, I guess, in both chambers?
I think it's interesting because David Long retired a couple years ago. The speaker, Speaker Brian Bonds, retired a year ago also as well. And so they're still kind of sort of navigating the process and the procedure. Because for folks like me and you who kind of cover this for a while, you know, our speakers have always been Brian Bosma and also sent David Long with the president pro tem. And so we sort of walked in where they already kind of knew what was going on because they've already had those positions for quite a while. And so I think sometimes we have the newer guys are still trying to sort of navigate, you know the process and the procedure. And so sometimes some bills will maybe sort of pop up that perhaps shouldn't have popped up, but something you just learn with experience.
What about the legislation that's being talked about where they would micromanage what school boards can allow teachers to talk about, especially the CRT issue that seems to be getting some coverage, especially in places like Virginia and other states?
That's interesting because Tony Cook, who's a state lawmaker from Cicero, which is sort of northern Hamilton County, has sort of been the sponsor of that bill, that legislation. Now, granted, there was a House version and a Senate version. A gentleman by the name of Scott Baldwin, who's a state senator from the Noblesville area, kind of made some comments about Nazis that sort of sunk that whole thing and sort of killed all that. And so the House basically did their version because although CRT isn't taught in schools, the critics of CRT say, well, they just do it another way. They just don't call it critical race theory. Instead, they call it, you know, socioeconomic learning and those sorts of things. And so they're trying to do this in such a way that increases parental involvement and transparency, which I am all for. But at the same time, parents aren't teachers, and so you got to let teachers sort of teach and do their thing. I think one of the things that lawmakers are probably going to end up doing is what's called a curriculum committee. And to give you folks an idea, because I used to serve on one when I lived back in Springfield, Illinois, the school district that I lived in, they had a curriculum committee. So there would be parents, business leaders, other folks in the Springfield area who would come in and be like 50 of us. And we sort of be broken up into different areas and talk about, hey, here's the book we're going to use. Here's what the teachers are going to teach. Now, at the end of the day, the schools had the final decision, but they made sure they had that parent and community involvement, sort of like these sort of advisory committees. So I think that'll probably be something that sort of comes out of a lot of this as we go forward. But as far as critical race theory goes, my friend, I'll bet you my cigar and comic book collection that most people in the sound of our voices, whether, you know, southern, central, or northern Indiana, have no idea what critical race theory is. They just think they're just not supposed to like it.
Yeah, and you've not seen any proof in the committee process where this is even being taught in Indiana schools, have you?
No.
So
not at all.
So basically, it's one of those issues where they fire up the base because it is an election year, it sounds like.
I jokingly say it is a solution in search of a problem.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way to say it. Well, what are the other hot issues? Since we're flush with money, and you mentioned that they're all kind of, at least in the majority party, they're kind of fighting amongst themselves to see who can be the most conservative, I guess might be the best way to describe it. What other issues are going on that maybe the average Hoosier hasn't paid that close attention to so far this session that could move?
Well, there is the issue of tax cuts. The House basically passed a bill with about $1 billion worth of tax cuts and some change, basically saying that the state of Indiana, since the state of Indiana is a flush and a wash with cash, then we can give some of that money back to the taxpayers, which I agree with in theory. However, you don't know necessarily. I hesitate to do that during a non-budget year, because when you do that during a non-budget year, you don't know what's going to, you know, what's your fiscal forecast, what's going to happen down the road. So the Senate has kind of cooled to those tax cuts ideas. So I don't see those coming up right away. I can see them being on the agenda for next year, which is a budget year, and you got sort of a two-year cycle. Then you can sort of plan a little bit better. Frankly, I'd much rather the state pay off its debt than cut taxes, because that way you freed up money down the road for other things. It's like paying off your credit card over time. That money used to go to pay your credit card bill. you don't have to do that anymore. Now you can spend on other stuff like cigars and whiskey.
It sounds like this is more of an election year kind of posturing. I know even when I served, we did it 1 year to try to show that, you know, I can remember John Gregg going to a Southside grocery store, and the House Democrats, when they were in charge, were trying to give away $100 rebates on an election year to try to see if that might help the majority charge at that time. But it sounds like it's more political than it is really when it comes to, is this really going to be a real change in policy? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but what do you think?
I think basically, like I said, a lot of folks have ideas, you know, that they've been meaning to get to for a while. And the state of Indiana is flush with cash. You know, we got sitting on $5 billion and some change. Now, granted, a bunch of that also comes from the federal government, the American Recovery Act, and those sorts of things. But like I said, and just sort of depends on what your philosophy is. Like I said, the Democrats say, hey, let's take some of this money and make some investments, you know, childcare education, you know, food insecurity, those sorts of things. But the issue with that is that once you don't use one-time dollars, as you know, as a business person, you don't use one-time money for recurring expenses. Now, you use it for capital improvements, like, say, buying a new antenna for DLC Media, which, by the way, I saw you on Facebook, having to mess with that stuff. So I have my deepest sympathy, my friend. But you don't use one-time money for ongoing expenses. So that when Democrats talk about investments in education and teacher pay, okay, that's fine, but where's the next set of money going to come from? On the flip side of the tax cut issue is, okay, you're going to cut taxes, that's fine, but you still get all this debt out here, which is why I prefer you pay off your debt, then that way you freed up money, you know, for tax cuts and for ongoing expenditures.
We would just like to get good cell phone service in this part of the state, let alone internet access for everyone. That's still how far we are behind in parts of West Central Indiana, believe it or not. So, hey, you're in Indianapolis, and I know that we hear a lot of talk about how bad the crime rate continues to zoom in the state's capital city. What are you seeing? And what's going on exactly on why we keep seeing such higher crime in Indianapolis, and what can be done about it?
Well, part of the issue is COVID. It's a mental health issue. You got people sort of maybe staying indoors and being around folks that normally they wouldn't be around. So that maybe has raised tensions somewhat. But one thing I've noticed is sort of our, for lack of, we've had a situation we're here with an organization called the Bail Project. And the Bail Project is a charitable not-for-profit group that it does. Its original purpose is to provide bail for low-level offenders because they don't believe people should stay in jail because they can't afford, you know, to pay bail, which theoretically I agree with. However, the issue has been there were three instances where folks they bailed out end up going back committing crimes. Two committed murder, another person stabbed two police officers. And so that's caused a bit of a stir. I think at the end of the day, what our issue is here in Marion County, because I went through and did a story on my website, indypolitics.org, about the murders we had last year, and I noticed once again a trend that 70% of the suspects and about 80% of the victims all have prior criminal adult felonies, whether it's crime against a person, drugs, or crime with a weapon. And so for some strange reason, the bad guys are getting back out on the streets and folks are taking justice into their own hands. And so until we get that issue taken care of, then you're going to have a serious sort of murder problem, a murder issue here in our capital city. Now, for the most part, though, 80% of the time, most victims and the perpetrators know each other. And as the former police chief used to say, if you're not, you know, doing drugs at 2 o'clock in the morning on the east side of town in an alley, odds of you being a murder victim are slim to almost none. The problem is, though, is when you got kids and older folks, you know, sort of caught in the crossfire. That to me is the bigger issue. And so I think, you know, dealing with that revolving, sort of that revolving jail door will go a long way to solving our homicide murder issue.
You know, 15, 25 years ago when I served in the General Assembly, you could walk around downtown Indy at night and have no fear. I mean, would you walk around in downtown Indianapolis at night? Are things getting that much worse, or am I just kind of overreacting to what I'm hearing?
I mean, I would say downtown is like any other downtown or any other place. You always kind of pay attention to your surroundings. So you walk with confidence. You sort of keep an eye out on things. And for the most part, you'll be fine. I think the issue is, once again, it's someone who shot somebody, they got out of jail because of, you know, the bail system or whatever, because the judge let them out, and so their family member's mad and ticked off of them, so they go back and get some kind of revenge. I think that's the bulk of the crux of our crime-related issue.
Homelessness in downtown Indy, worse or better, about the same? What are you seeing?
I think it's gotten a little bit better, and I think it's gotten better because in part we've had a lot of downtown events, And so because you've got downtown events, folks have kind of said, hey, we have a homeless problem. Maybe we need to clean this up a little bit. So there's been a lot of moving of homeless people. There's no longer the homeless camp that used to be on the east side of Monument Circle a couple winters ago, which was just ridiculous. It looked like a scene out of a science fiction movie called District 9. So you guys ever take a look at it, feel free. but I think the homeless issue is getting better. Obviously, their root causes, long-term issues. And I remind people, too, that in Indianapolis, there's a issue between people who are homeless versus panhandlers. There's a big difference between those two types of people, because the homeless people you never really see, because the homeless people, unfortunately, are sleeping in an alley between two trash cans. Those people who really need our help. The guy who's begging for change because he left his family on I-65, on 465, and so he walked all the way downtown to get money for gas. Like, okay, come on, dude. Let's be serious here.
Yeah, I see some of those same people with signs up even in our area. So,
yeah.
Any other issues that could become a little more visible as the final weeks of the General Assembly get to near the finish line?
Well, something that popped up that I thought was interesting was for my Republican friends who I say came to govern as social conservatives. It seemed like early on, essentially, they were governed as conservative socialists because there was legislation that would have put price controls on the wholesale distribution of soda pop. And so basically what the bill said was that whether it's soda pop or energy drinks or water, or bottled water, if it was sold by a wholesale distributor, they could not charge a convenience store more than Walmart or Target. And so the convenience store right there in Washington, Indiana, would get the same price for soda pop as the Walmart would. And so that was like one of these things. Another bill that popped up was you had to take cash. Another bill was that if you're a business that wanted to boycott fossil fuels, the state of Indiana wouldn't do business with you, which and sort of had me kind of scratch my head, like, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
It's like the free market, can't let the free market sort of do its thing. Like, what's going on? Now, granted, as well as I do, a lot of that stuff is, somebody, got a bug in their ear, so they called the lawmaker friend and said, hey, I want you to take care of, X, Y, Z. But it seemed really odd and sort of more of those bills kind of popped up than usual. But once again, that's what happens when you got $5 billion in the bank and no money problems.
Right, and you've got too many members of one caucus, and it's kind of like herding cats to try to keep them all on the same page, I'm sure.
Actually, that's offensive to anybody who had to herd cats.
Yeah. So. Well, what about the handgun issue? They're talking about no permit would be required long-term for Indiana. Is that going to move?
It moved out of the House, what they call permitless or constitutional carry. It is over in the Senate. The Senate version of that bill did not get through. And so it'll be interesting to see what exactly happens with permitless or quote-unquote constitutional carry. I mean, I'm all for your Second Amendment rights to own a gun, to hunt and protect your family. That I don't have an issue with. However, there should be some way for law enforcement to know who is legalized and who is legally authorized to carry and who isn't. And so that's always been kind of my thing. And the argument that, well, I should need a permit to exercise my Second Amendment rights. So, okay, well, that's fine. But what about voting? You got to show an ID. So,
yeah,
come on. We've always kind of regulated sort of the no right is absolute. We've always sort of regulated the time, place, and manner of a lot of our constitutional rights. So making sure someone's got a permit, they're authorized to carry, I don't see what the big deal is.
And you mentioned the voting situation. I hate the idea that, okay, if you're going to vote absentee, you may be under a felony charge if all of a sudden you really aren't leaving the state so many days before the election. I mean, are they really serious about this?
Yes. Now, my issue with that is, let's say it's because vote centers are kind of are starting to pop up all over the place now. And so that way you can go anywhere to a vote center. As long as you live in the county and you're registered to vote there, you can vote. So that I've never had an issue with. My question has always been with that legislation is, what if you're a person that doesn't have a vote center in your county just yet, and you just don't know, if you're going to be able to make it or not? Because, a lot of people are a lot more mobile these days, and we don't know what our schedules are going to be. Heck, I don't even know what I'm doing at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Right.
Or, or tomorrow morning for that matter. So my issue has always been is, just if someone wants to vote absentee, let them vote absentee, sign the affidavit. Now, I do believe you should have some sort of ID, whether it's the last four digits of your driver's license number or social security number, just to prove that that's you and not some schmuck doing whatever. But otherwise, then just let people vote and just be done with it.
Yeah, they seem to be chasing a problem that really doesn't exist, but but I guess that seems to be a standard, I guess, that we're seeing in a lot of states where they're heavily Republican controlled. I guess maybe it's kind of Is there some truth to the fact that they may be trying to make it tougher to vote in cities like Indianapolis and Gary because of little changes like this, in your opinion?
I don't think it's necessarily more difficult to vote because the speaker did make an interesting point when he spoke to us last week, which is, unlike Election Day, which is like 10 years ago, you know, now you got basically 30 days to get your vote in. And so I butt up with my Democrat and more progressive friends. It's like, hey, you know, just get your people registered. Go get them to vote. You know, get good quality candidates. And as soon as that day one shows up in that 30-day cycle, you know, get your vote in then and there and get it done now. And so that way you don't have to worry about, you know, long lines at vote centers or polling places, you know, on Election Day.
We've only got a few minutes left in the program, and I want to touch on politics. First of all, there's been a rumor floating around for a few weeks now that Eric Holcomb may run for Mike Braun's Senate seat, and Mike Braun may run for governor. Is there any legs to that story?
I'm not sure about the governor running for the U.S. Senate yet. I do know Mike Braun is not happy with his place in the U.S. Senate, because Mike Braun is always more of sort of an executive business person than a legislative kind of guy. And so he was here a couple of weeks ago, kind of talked to us folks in the media, and he didn't automatically say no. Let's put it that way. But you got him thinking about running for governor. You've got Congressman Jim Banks up in the Fort Wayne area thinking about running for governor. You've got Suzanne Crouch thinking about running. You've got Eric Doden, who is the former head of the IEDC under Mike Pence, thinking about running for governor. And, of course, everybody's favorite Attorney General Todd Rokita, who likes to go down the border on taxpayers' expense, thinking about running for governor, too.
Yeah, so. good friend of yours, right, Todd Rokita? I know you guys have had some battles here lately. And, you know, I've even carried legislation for him when he was Secretary of State. But Todd doesn't seem to miss a press hit whenever he can find it, no matter how ridiculous the news release might be, I guess. But we'll see.
I jokingly say the last place you want to be is between Todd Rokita and the media. Otherwise, you might get hurt.
That's an interesting point. Well, how about on the Democrat side? Do you think there's any truth to the fact that they're trying to recruit on the Democratic side Joe Donnelly to run for governor? Or is he going to be happy just kind of wrapping up his career at the Vatican as our ambassador to the Vatican?
If I was Joe Donnelly, I'd just stick at the Vatican.
Yeah.
And just leave it at that. I mean, if you've been a congressman, you've been a U.S. senator, you've done your part in politics, I would say just kind of let it go. Now, Pete Buttigieg is a possible contender as well for possibly running for governor. But what I think what I will give the Democrats credit for that they're doing that they hadn't really seen done before, at least in the past 10 years and some change, is really get out of the, you know, out of the big cities and go talk to people, you know, that you need to vote for in rural areas, because you can't just win with Indianapolis and Gary and Evansville. You need a good portion of those rural and sort of suburban voters to find out what's going on. And that's why I say do the Howard Dean thing, which is run candidates that fit the district. You know, if somebody is, you know, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, then that should not be a prohibition on them, you know, running as a Democrat. So you got to find candidates that meet the district, meet the voters where they are, and then go from there.
We had an interesting situation this week in Vigo County where a Democratic member of the county council flipped to the Republican side and gave the Republicans control of the county council, and they already had control of the commissioners, which in Vigo County, nobody can remember how long it's been since Republicans had control of both the council and the commission. So that kind of tells you that how far the Republicans have come in an area that has always been perceived and as a Democratic area.
Exactly. And then that's what and that's the thing that and I think part of it is sort of the national Democratic Party doesn't fully appreciate, you know, some of those conservative Democrats. Just like I would say the national Republicans Republicans don't appreciate, you know, those moderate voters. So the middle is where things get lost as in our politics these days.
Yep, I agree with you. I mean, it seems like the far fringe on the Democrats are on the left and the far fringe on the Republicans are on the right. And the rest of us in the middle are just trying to figure out, can we get back to some normality? But I guess, I don't know, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Anything else we've left out when it comes to our final minute or so that might be political in nature, since the deadline to file as we're recording this is just about an hour away?
It's interesting to see the number of conservative Republicans who've gotten primary challengers, people like Kurt Nicely, Tim Wesko, John Jacobs here in Indianapolis. So it'll be interesting to see with redistricting, who stays in and who drops out. And I'll be happy to come back a little bit later this summer, maybe after session, and we can talk about that as well, my friend.
And by the way, I don't see the Democrats picking up any House and Senate seats this year. Do you?
There may be a couple that they might, because, you know, in politics, anything is possible. And a day in politics is like a lifetime. And all it takes is somebody to be caught with a live boy or dead girl. And the next thing you know, that's all she wrote.
I get that. But and then one more thing on the U.S. Senate race. It sounds like Democrats have potentially at least two candidates running to try to challenge Todd Young this fall.
Yes. Tom McDermott, he turned in his signatures this week, and he's good to go. And I want to say Hanifa, it's either going to be Hanifa Khalif or Valerie McCray will be one of the two Democratic candidates. The signatures are due, like I said, as we record this conversation, about 50 minutes and some change. So it'll be interesting to see who had their signatures, who's got their signatures. Todd Young was going to have an opponent in the name of Danny Niederberger, but Danny did not get all the signatures in.
And a lot of people don't understand that, but if you don't have 500 signatures from actual voters in each of the congressional districts, you can't even get on the ballot in this state for Senate and governor, and that's not an easy bar to actually rise to, of course, in this state.
And actually, you need more, at least 600, because, you know, people make mistakes. Like, yeah, I live in the 5th District, but I really live in the 7th, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a good point. So, well, always a pleasure to talk to you, Abdul. Appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to give us kind of an update on the State House during the short session, as well as politics around the Hoosier State. And I'm sure we'll talk more later this year.
Hey, not a problem, my friend. Anytime. By the way, I love all the good things you're doing with DLC Media and bringing local news and important issues to people in all parts of our great state.
Well, thank you very much, my friend, and we'll talk again soon. All right, that's Abdul Akeem Shabazz, a State House reporter for WIBC and also the creator of IndyPolitics.org. This has been Focus on the Community for the weekend of February 6, 2022, produced by the DLC Media News Center. For a download of this show and other past programs, visit any of our radio station websites. I'm Dave Crooks. Thanks for listening.